You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz in for Tenzina Vega. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he expected violence between Israeli forces and Hamas to de-escalate and move towards a ceasefire in the coming days. But in response, Netanyahu said that Israel will continue their military operation until its aim is met. This month, Israel's military has killed at least 227 Palestinians, including more than 60 children. Meanwhile, 12 people have been killed in Israel, including 2 children. As is often the case when conflict flares in this tiny part of the Middle East, debates in the U.S. have been raging about media coverage of the situation.
Now, let's make one thing clear. Israel has a right to exist and to defend itself. That is an indisputable fact. But so do Palestinians. And that's a fact that's often ignored. Palestinians are, at best, third-class citizens in the nation of their birth.
Do you support the protests, the violent protests that have erupted in solidarity with you and other families in your position right now?
Do you support the violent dispossession of me and my family?
Oh, the terrorists of Hamas clearly intent on killing as many Israelis as possible. And critics point out also causing untold casualties among the citizens of Gaza, even as more Hamas rockets are raining down on the Jewish state.
That was MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. Meanwhile, on social media, progressives criticize mainstream Western outlets for being biased in favor of Israel, while the other side calls out media criticism of Israel's actions, since human rights abuses by governments elsewhere in the world go virtually ignored in the American discourse. With me now to discuss how media coverage and social media takes on this conflict are being perceived, particularly in American Jewish communities, is Batya Unger-Sargon, Deputy Opinion Editor for Newsweek and co-host of Newsweek's podcast, The Debate. Nice to talk to you again, Batya.
Oh my gosh, Matt, thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Also with us is Peter Beinart, Editor-at-Large for Jewish Currents and author of the Beinart Notebook on Substack. Welcome back to the show, Peter.
Thanks.
Peter, have you noticed any differences in how the current violence in Israel and Palestine is being reported and analyzed by the media here compared to previous instances of this violence?
Yes, I think that there are more Palestinian voices that are present in the kind of mainstream U.S. media than I remember, let's say, back in 2014 or in 2008, 2009, which were previous wars between Israel and Gaza. And I think that's part of a growing recognition in general in the U.S. media about issues of representation. And so I think people have become more self-conscious about the fact that Palestinians have historically not been very well represented in this mainstream media discussion. And then, of course, on social media, I think you have even more representation of Palestinian voices. And so I think together that does mark a significant shift.
It seems like this is the first major flare-up in hostilities since the advent of social media being so universal in our lives, right, Peter? That must be factoring into all of this.
Yeah, I suppose social media was around, but obviously its prominence has grown. And I don't think you can divorce the kind of technological changes from the fact that we have been really in recent years in a moment of real a kind of surge of progressive activism across a whole range of issues in a way that was really not the case, let's say, during the Obama years. And although most of that activism is not around Israel-Palestine, it does have implications, I think, for the way that people see Israel-Palestine and for the, because there's a general kind of, I would say, a kind of worldview perspective that this has implications for how people operate on this issue.
Batya, let's talk about the surge of this progressive worldview when it comes to this particular issue. You recently wrote a piece entitled When Wokeness Comes for Israel, which criticizes several outlets for their coverage. What are your main issues with the way this has been handled?
Yeah, so it's funny. I'm not going to disagree yet with Peter. I actually agree that there was, over the course of the Trump administration, what a lot of sociologists have called a great awakening. And this didn't happen among communities of color. It happened among white liberals. And so I do disagree with Peter that what we're seeing is more Palestinian voices. What we're seeing is actually the mainstreaming of a woke worldview among white liberals. What I call wokeness is the insistence on a re-racialization of everything into a power binary that portrays one side as all powerful and the other side as totally powerless. And this is really what you've seen happen to the conversation about race in America, right? We see the whole conversation divide people into their racial group affiliation. You have white people who are privileged and powerful and uphold white supremacy on the one hand, and at the expense of people of color who have no agency as far as woke people are concerned. And I think this language is incredibly dehumanizing. But this is now how Israel is seen by the far left, by woke activists, and by a newly woke media, and now even members of Congress too. So Israel is being cast as the kind of colonial white oppressor upholding a form of supremacy, and the Palestinians as their victims. And to me, this view is not just false, it's not just immoral, but it's completely counterproductive. It dehumanizes both sides, it erases the history of the region, and it uses maximalist claims to ensure that solutions will not occur. So just like abolish the police replaced both calls and legislation for police reform, so to have this new language about genocide and ethnic cleansing on the part of Israel replaced calls and even attempts to end the occupation, which is an important and noble goal.
Peter, do you think it's fair or even logical to graft messages that you might have seen at Black Lives Matter protests in the U.S. and put it onto the Palestinian cause?
On the one hand, of course, every world conflict is different. There are significant differences, of course, between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and between racial, you know, America's history of white supremacy. But it is also, I think, valuable for people to make kind of moral analogies between different forms of injustice. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that the moral analogy between the civil rights movement in the United States and the anti-apartheid movement, even though the situation in South Africa was in many ways very different, was an important way of making people recognize certain very core truths. I also remember that in the 1990s, the historical legacy of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Europe was an analogy that led many people, including many Jews, to be very active on the question of the ethnic cleansing of Bosnians in the mid-1990s. Didn't mean the situations were the same. Of course, they were not the same. But situations can be complicated and have nuance. And also, there can be certain simple, fundamental moral truths. Among them are that people deserve equality under the law and should not be treated differently based on their race, religion, or ethnicity. And you do see fundamentally in Israel-Palestine that Palestinians are treated differently than Israeli Jews. They have fewer rights because of their religion and their ethnicity. So in that way, I think there is an important moral analogy to be drawn between a situation in the United States where we have our own history of people being treated differently because of inherited characteristics.
Badia, it seems to me that every critique of how the story about what's going on there is told needs historical context. But then if you lead the story with Israeli rockets, then it's, well, Gaza shot into Israel first. But then it's, what about what happened at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem involving Israeli police arresting Palestinian worshipers? And then it's, well, what about 1967 borders and 1948 refugees? And soon enough, it's a biblical argument about who God gave this land to. It seems exhausting and endless, right, Baya?
I mean, I think, Matt, you just put your finger on why people would much prefer to graft an American racial story onto the Middle East than learn the history, right? Then engage in the moral and ethical and historical and civil rights questions that have plagued the two nations that live in the region. And so I do want to push back a little bit on what Peter said about comparing this to the American context in order to reach a kind of moral truth. I think the opposite is actually the case. And what I mean by that is, of course, it's true that there's police brutality against Palestinians in Jerusalem and in the West Bank, and there's police brutality against Black people in America. Those are both terrible and both really important that we talk about. But when the police or the U.S. government discriminates against Black people, those people have no one else to protect them. They are American citizens. It is their own government that's failing to protect their civil rights. And the history of white supremacy in America is one in which white people really viewed themselves as inherently superior for racial reasons, and they used that to justify those abuses, okay? So that's a situation of pure moral evil. And it's just not relevant to Israel at all. And I think that's because when Peter says, you know, that Palestinians are being systematically deprived of civil rights, this is true of Palestinians in the West Bank. It's true to a much, 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 much lesser degree of Palestinian citizens of Israel, right? So when we talk about the conflict, you know, when members of the squad talk about ethnic cleansing and genocide, they're not talking about Palestinian citizens of Israel who are an inherent and integral part of the nation of Israel. They're talking about Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza and in East Jerusalem who are not citizens of Israel. They see themselves as members of a different nation. In fact, many people in East Jerusalem have turned down citizenship offers. And there's no Jewish supremacy at stake. So Israel's Jewish policies stem from our genocidal history that justified Israel in the first place. Now, we can criticize those, we can debate them, but casting that as a form of white supremacy or supremacy is to me really morally perverse. It really borders on even, you know, Holocaust erasure. And, you know, the third point I would make is that, you know, the Palestinians are not agentless here. Israel does have more power in the situation, but to equate power with morality or with justice, I think this is a mistake that the left makes often. And I also don't see this as morally credible.
Peter, this is very interesting that these discussions and the way we talk about this has also been changing in Washington. Biden mentioned the squad. Politico reported that a staunch Democratic ally of Israel in Congress said, "We have lost the emotional side of the argument." You have luminaries like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders pushing back against U.S. support for Israel's military actions. What is changing in Congress right now when it comes to this issue?
I think a lot of it is that people are feeling comfortable saying things that Democrats, that they always believed. I mean, one does need to be careful about terms here, but let's be clear. You know, more than 700,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes in 1948. Yes, a small number of them fled in terror. Most of them were expelled by force. Many other hundreds of thousands were expelled in Israel's war in 1967. And Palestinian citizens of Israel are nowhere near close to having the same basic rights as Israeli Jews. If you just look at Israel's land policy, there's a reason that Palestinian citizens represent 19% of Israel's population and live on 3% of Israel's land. People are starting to understand this. And when we talk about, you know, the problem with analogizing struggles for racial justice and equality in the United States with those in Israel-Palestine, what's striking to me is I've never heard a Palestinian complain about that. I've never heard a Palestinian complain about that, because Palestinians, who are the ones who are suffering fundamental denial of basic rights, actually, in my experience, overwhelmingly welcome the solidarity of people around the world, whoever they are, who understand from their own experience what that's like.
Badia, is it possible that the shift in this conversation isn't all necessarily because of wokeness, as you say, but Israel may be acting more aggressively in this situation than in the past, and maybe has acted differently under Netanyahu than maybe in previous generations of Israeli leadership? And that's what politicians in Washington are responding to.
I don't think that is the case. I don't want to compare like civilian casualties to prior times. Every civilian casualty is an enormous loss and just an infinite loss. But I can say that there is always a problem with police brutality in East Jerusalem. This current round of conflict was started by some inexplicable police brutality in East Jerusalem from my point of view. So in that sense, I think you're correct. But I think that what we're really seeing is that I don't see how anyone can go on social media and not see this new discourse as being the result of the bullying and dogpiling that happens on Twitter by far left activists and now by members of Congress as well. I mean, it's just absolutely brutal. And just one thing that I have to say is that, you know, just as it's clear that Trump's anti-China rhetoric led to an increase in racist attacks against Asian Americans, the fever pitch of the accusations that Israel is in apartheid and committing ethnic cleansing and genocide are coinciding with a huge spike in Jews being attacked on the streets of America and Europe. And there's just crickets in the mainstream media. And I don't understand this. I mean, it's so clear to us how vile rhetoric can lead to attacks against vulnerable populations when it's coming from the right. But somehow when members of, you know, pro-Palestinian rallies across the world have been breaking off and attacking Jews on the streets, it's not even recognizable. I don't think the mainstream media is being silent because I think they can't even see it. So I would urge your listeners to take that away from the takeaway and to think about that a little bit.
Thank you, Baya. Peter, we have a few seconds left. Do you have something to leave either listeners or journalists who are trying to cover this very fraught story?
Yes, I would say I totally agree with Batya about vile rhetoric leading to anti-Semitic attacks and how we can have no tolerance for that. But it's important to distinguish between vile anti-Semitic rhetoric and speaking hard but important truths. Calling Israel an apartheid state is something that Israel's own most prominent human rights organization, B'Tselem, did earlier this year, along with Human Rights Watch. That in and itself, you can debate it, but it's not anti-Semitic, and it's not fair to accuse people who use those terms as being responsible for anti-Semitic violence, in my opinion.
Peter Beinart is author of the Beinart Notebook on Substack. Batya Unger-Sargon is the deputy opinion editor for Newsweek and co-host of Newsweek's podcast, The Debate. Thank you both for joining us and for having a cordial and critical conversation about this issue.
Matt, you're a man of integrity, and I'm so happy to have been here.
Thanks very much.